You're listening to Inside iOS Dev, show about real-world iOS development. Today with you, your host, Alex Bush. And today I have a very special guest again, Daniel Hall. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, I'm getting less special every time.
And today we are going to be talking about something that I suspect a lot of our listeners wanted me to talk about, which is Swift UI. But this time around, I won't be the one sort of bashing on it, because I think everyone knows my opinion about Swift UI. Daniel here is an expert relative to myself. I know he doesn't think so, but I think he is expert on Swift UI, and he played with it and kind of researched documentation lately. So we'll talk about certain issues with it and kind of limitations. And specifically, I think it's protocols, right? Or using protocols for data observation is what's tough.
Yeah.
In Swift UI.
I think so. Yeah, particularly when we're talking about our kind of traditional things where we want to be able to like mock our data sources or hide concrete types. If we want a view that's very reusable, and we don't want to know where the data comes from, we want to be able to hide the concrete type. That's certainly a lot more challenging in Swift UI. Although I do want to say as a disclaimer, I'm actually a big fan of Swift UI. I think so much of it is brilliant and great. Not that I'm not still really wrestling with wrapping my head around it. It's a very different paradigm. But I do think it's worth talking about some of these rough edges as they exist today.
I myself, though, I played lately with it a bit more. I'm building a Mac app. I don't know if I'll ever publish it, but hopefully, fingers crossed. I can, even though I, again, don't like it really, but I cannot say that, I can say that making rapidly building UI and prototype and building UI and it being more intuitive is the case and is a benefit of Swift UI, definitely. I don't know how polishing of the UI goes, right, and really making it super custom, I don't know yet because I haven't used it in production, but for this little app that I have to quickly put together a list of items and little progress bar and show some computations and UI and labels, right? That was fast, easy, and intuitive, way more intuitive than auto layout. And specifically like the VStack and HStack and how they behave was more like a flexbox, and I loved that. It's just intuitive, makes sense. And auto layout, I worked with it for so many years. I still quite often wire some connections up, some constraints, and I think they work a certain way, but they don't. And then I have to debug it and all.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the layout system, I remember being pretty mind blown watching their description of it. It's a very clever layout system. I think it's a lot more direct. It's a lot less recursive than auto layout. I'm suspecting that it's more performant and less likely to run into some of these crazy, who hasn't seen a console full of ambiguous constraint right. Runtime warnings, right? That just doesn't happen in Swift UI, which is pretty awesome. I think my impression so far is that, there's this old rule, like, at least Apple's talked about for a long time. It's like, we want to make the 80% cases easy and the 20% cases possible. I think Swift UI definitely makes a lot of things incredibly easy. Like sometimes just wow, amazingly so. I think its real rough edges come along when you're trying to customize it. Like it can get thorny really quickly. It even makes some hard things easy, but it also sometimes makes some specific simple things hard. So it's a very interesting mixed bag right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think they definitely do not cover the last 20% yet.
Yes, definitely not.
But today specifically, right, what we were talking about is data observation, right, and usage of protocols there, with those special, not keywords, I keep calling them keywords, but they're really, what is it?
Property wrappers.
Property wrappers, thank you, yes. At state, at observable object, right?
Observed object,
yeah. Observed object, and what was the third one?
And then there's at environment object.
Right. So what's, let's start with what's the difference between them?
Yeah. So one of the ideas behind SwiftUI is that, you know, once a view is constructed, it's done. Like, unlike UIKit, you can't change a view once it's been kind of constructed. And so, and that's the key to that, you know, var body some view. Like, whenever it needs to be re-rendered, it just calls that. It says, okay, give me your view again, your body. So what needs to happen is that inside that body, it's accessing things from its properties. So you have these different properties where it has data or state, and it's going to use that to decide how to lay out. And what you need is, you need to somehow know, SwiftUI needs to know, if any of that data or those properties have changed, what it needs to do is just trigger the system to get the body again, and it will recalculate based on whatever new values are there. So in one sense, all of those property wrappers do the same thing. And what they do is they represent some sort of data that you can use while you're constructing the body, where the SwiftUI system is keeping track of whether those things change or not. And so if any of those values change, they trigger the body to be re-rendered. So that's how they're all kind of essentially the same. The difference is where those things come from. So for the two object ones, you've got environment object and observed object. That is something that has to conform to this observable object protocol. And what that protocol does is it has a named publisher that can be subscribed to that just says, I changed. It can do lots of little tricks and stuff for you, like automatically knowing when things changed if you use certain property wrappers inside that thing. But ultimately, you're responsible from an observable object to just, if some data changed inside of you, you got to send a signal, emit from this publisher, I changed. And that tells SwiftUI to re-render the body that was listening for that. So an at observed object is one of these observable object things that you have to actually pass in, and you have to explicitly hand to that view. Mm-hmm. So observed object, you need to really pass it in through the initializer. You have to give it the thing and say, this is what you're going to be observing.
And that's obviously before the body, I was going to say method, but the body computed property is called.
Yeah. It really has to be in the initializer. Mm-hmm. You're going to hand that in.
And it cannot be, because of the nature of SwiftUI structs being constantly recomputed, it cannot even be a publicly assignable property, right?
Correct.
Because you don't really get an object instance to use of your SwiftUI, not really.
That's right. And if you tried, because it's a struct, it's a value type, you would only be getting a copy of it anyway, not the
right. Not I the mean, actual thing. I guess hypothetically, you could have declared it as a mutated property or whatnot, right? Or mutable, whatever it's called. And then you could reassign it on your struct, right? Well, but then every time, at least when I played with it, as far as I understood, every time it just gets recomputed. It's a new instance, a new struct. So you don't even have the reference to, you can't, basically just can't assign it.
That's right. And you know, if you look at how you lay out these view hierarchies, when you embed a view in the other view, you don't say var this embedded view. It's just there. It's created. It's immutable. So even a mutating property here wouldn't really matter, because basically every view is, none of the views that get created throughout this whole hierarchy are vars.
It's actually, yeah, a good point. I just realized that. I was looking at it all the time, but I had never registered with me. Yeah, you don't even, like, what you could have done in a UI view, right, in UI kit, you could have in your initializer of your custom view that you're making, you could have created other view subviews that you want to have later, and then in that body computed property call, you could have just added them as subviews.
Yep.
But you're not, you just don't do that. This is not how it,
And this is one of the things, you know, I'm like a type system nerd, and I think this is one of the very brilliant things about Swift UI is, you know, the idea that you can, anybody from outside of you can kind of change properties in any order at any time willy-nilly is a very dangerous sort of situation. And there's lots of debates about constructor injection versus property injection and constructor injection. Constructor injection is literally the only type of injection possible.
It is really, yeah.
Which is kind of awesome. It's limiting, but it's really deterministic.
Yeah, actually, I agree. Yeah, in that regard, it's that is great.
Yeah,
but then you cannot inject a view, though. You probably rarely would do that. I acknowledge it that that's like crazy edge case, but you can't, right?
Well, I mean, you kind of can. I mean,
can you?
You can. While you're rendering the body, you can call out to functions, or you can ask for a view as you're rendering the body, as long as you know
as long as it's a view type of view, right? Of that Swift UI. I see.
And generally, the system wants to know when you're constructing that body, like what's the specific view, and it constructs a very specific type for the entire hierarchy. But you can also erase things to just be in any view. So you can go and grab them at render time, but you cannot change where you're going to get that view from once you've initialized the struct. Anywhere where it's going to get that view from, whether it's an observed object, some global function, wherever, that's kind of baked in. It's going to go to the same place every time that body is rendered and get the same view from wherever it's getting it from.
I see. But I think we've sidetracked a little. But back to yeah. The at observed object, right? Is that how
right.
It's called?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you can think of this as kind of, you can think of it as your view model, some data, some collection of information, which you're going to use to fill in string, you know, like text labels, or could be colors or data or the number of
lists,
items,
right,
lists, what have you. So this object, anytime it changes again, it will cause Swift UI to regenerate this body. But the thing about add observed object is, you have to basically pass whatever that thing is into the initializer and set it. And then, you know, anytime it changes, the body will be regenerated.
And is that the case where you do that dollar sign thing on it? Or what was it, dollar sign?
Yeah, yeah. Probably not. I mean, if you do a dollar sign, it kind of, it generates, there's different projections, but it usually generates a binding. Maybe that's another can of worms, but
yeah, fair enough.
So that's observed object. Environment object is the same idea, except that, rather than having an instance of this observable object that's passed in the initializer and set, you can think of environment object as kind of a getter that goes and gets that instance for you dynamically. It looks it up through Swift UI's mechanisms. the challenge there is that the way that works is that SwiftUI will look at the type of that. So let's say you have a view called list view, and it has an at environment object called list view model, or that's the type of it. Under the hood, when you try to, in the body, access that view model, SwiftUI will go and it will check this dictionary that it keeps, and it will say, okay, for this type, list view model, I'm using the type as a key. I'm going to look for an instance of that thing and then pass it down here to the body to use. So this is a form of dependency injection. The problem is if you did not actually register an instance of a list view model in that view hierarchy, it will crash at runtime when it tries to go get it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you would do, so the way you would work with it, you declare at environment object as mm-hmm. one of the properties inside of your view. Mm-hmm. You say then var its name, and then its type, in this case, list view model, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you need to, and you could say it's a private property, right? Even though it says at environment object, it could be private, right?
Yep.
Okay. And then you go somewhere else and you say, and then you have to add that to your environment in that object and list or whatever in that view, right?
So the way that works in SwiftUI is, you know, you're always kind of adding this root view to the window, and the root mm-hmm. view has all the views you might navigate to, all the things that might be shown.
Right. And that would be the root, like when you create that UI host in view controller.
Correct.
That's basically kind of where it all starts, right?
Yes. And so in that root view, for every subview or view that will be transitioned to in that hierarchy, you have to register on that root view. You would say, you'd create the root view, mm-hmm. and you would say, you would use the modifier dot environment object, and then you'd have to put a list view model in there. And then dot environment object, any other view model that's dot environment object, and then any other one that's going to be needed.
I see. So in this case, that view model specifically, and every other similar object that you pass, they will have to conform to a protocol or something like that, right?
Right. They all have to be observable objects. Observable. That is true.
Got it. Just like in the case of if they're not passed not through environment, but if they are observed object, they also will have to conform to the same protocol.
That's correct.
Got it. So I didn't know that. So I thought, because I haven't kind of touched environment objects at all before, not yet. I thought there is another additional, like a special type that you implement or subclass from, and that would be your environment object, like struct. And you in there, you put a list of those view models or whatever you have that will be accessible down in your hierarchy of Swift UI.
So that's really interesting. It could be, there's yet another thing called at environment.
So that's different from at environment object.
Correct.
Oh my God. Okay. Tell me more.
So at environment is a little different because it is strongly typed. Implicitly, every view that kind of creates another view and goes down, every view in the hierarchy can get this environment values struct from its parent, which gets it from its parent, et cetera, et cetera. And if you want, and this is how SwiftUI handles things like trait collection, whether we're, you know, what size class are we in, and things like what is our preferred font size, and are we in dark mode or not in dark mode? These are kind of like really value types that are kind of are talking about the environment that everybody can read from, any view can read from, simply by making an at environment property wrapped variable and then saying what key path on that struct they want to pull from.
Like an old key value observation key path?
Like a Swift key path, you know, the backslash dot. So if you've got a struct.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Mm-hmm. And so the compiler does check this one. This is a strongly typed.
Interesting.
This is a strongly typed thing, but it does not work the same way where these values update. Like they're not pulling data. This is almost like configuration data, if you think about it, that gets passed down through the view hierarchy.
I see.
Kind of like a trait collection, really.
So you create that root, roughly speaking, what happens? You create that root view, you pass environment to it rather than environment object. And there, and whatever you pass there is just simply statically available throughout everything in that tree. And it cannot, and those things cannot be updated to refresh UI.
Well, that is exactly correct. They do not get updated to refresh UI. The cool thing about it, there's two cool things about it. One is that if you want to add your own properties to this environment values struct, they have to conform to this protocol, which means that you have to specify a default value for them. So nothing in the environment values can ever not be initialized or have a value.
Right.
There will always at least be a default. So that means it's safe. You will never crash using environment.
And that environment stuff gets resolved before even the view is even rendered, right?
That's a good question.
Logically, probably, right?
It gets passed down, I think, as SwiftUI is rebuilding the hierarchy. Because the interesting thing is that any view, kind of by default, will pass. Again, remember, environment values is a struct, so you're actually passing a copy down the chain, not a pointer. So any parent anywhere along the chain can modify a property. So like, let's say once you get inside this subview, you want to be in dark mode just for the subview. You could do that because the parent will change that property.
Wait, it will change.
That's what gets passed down.
It will change the, a parent will change the environment property for its children?
For its children. All of its children. But because it's a struct, it doesn't change it for any of its ancestors or its peers. Because it's changing a copy and then passing it down to its children.
Ouch. Wait, really?
Yeah. I think it's fantastic. I mean, it's the beauty of value types, right? Is like, I can change the environment here that I will then pass down to my children, but this does not have unexpected side effects for anyone else that has a different copy of the environment.
I see what you mean.
Or I change it.
If it was a reference type, you technically could mess with it, but then you could make it a let, so you can't really like mutate it.
But you want the power to say, for example, like in UI trait collections, you're allowed in UIKit to say this side, like this container view controller has a left side, which is compact and a right side, which is regular. Mm-hmm. Like you're allowed to override some of these things. So, even things like text color, all of these things actually get kind of passed down here. So it's a little bit like, I don't want to say like CSS, but
I'm just trying to think of a use case. Yeah.
Oh boy. I wish I could remember all the things that are in there.
I guess I'm talking specifically about the use case of overriding it. Like the theme thing, you would probably never do a special theme just for one of the subviews, but what you would want to do is to react to time change. And at night, you make in Google Maps application. And at night, you want to switch to dark mode like literally on the fly at runtime when 6 p.m. strikes or something, right?
Uh-huh.
Then this environment thingy is not suitable for that because you're not really observing it, right?
That's interesting.
Yeah, you do pass
down. I guess
down
that's true.
The
I
theme,
guess that's true.
Similar yeah. theme throughout the whole tree, sure.
But it yeah, you literally couldn't really trigger off of it because it's not an object. It's not a single thing that everybody's watching. Everybody's watching. I mean, nobody's watching it.
Exactly.
What happens is I believe that it gets passed in right before your body is rendered. You get your parent either implicitly or explicitly. Because when you're creating a view from a parent view, let's say you say like list detail view, and you're creating that from the list view, you would say dot environment, and then you would set a new value for that key there. So the process of re-rendering this whole hierarchy is where these values might get changed. You still need some data that triggers that whole re-render. You could certainly yeah. dynamically set, you know, you could say, you could have some logic that looks at the time at the moment you render it and says, if the time is
that's fair,
before
yeah.
here, I'm going to make it dark, otherwise I'll make it light. So, but there is no change or update to the values that happens independently of this render pass.
Right. If you would want to do that, you would want to use environment object.
Instead,
and you would need to have it be passed down to all of the views, right?
That's right.
Got it.
So I think CSS maybe isn't the worst analogy because, you know, when you apply a style and you're doing web development, that style applies to everything mm-hmm. inside of that container mm-hmm. until something else overrides it. And so it's really very much that exact same concept, which is if you want something to have a background color that's red, and you set that, everything's going to have that same background color unless something else inside that hierarchy says, no, from this point on, we're going to do a different background color.
I really want to see now how people will use it because I just quite often how you color and style stuff depends on your runtime data, right? Well, yeah. I mean, the dark theme is one example, sure, like sort of an obvious one. But maybe you want to, you download data from the backend and you show, you have your font as green when it's successful download and it says success with exclamation mark. And you want to have your font as red when it's error and it says error. Like you can't really use environment for that.
So what's super interesting is that, you know, the SwiftUI has all these modifiers, these view modifiers, and you can set like a foreground color or a background yeah, color. Yeah. Not all, but a lot of these modifiers, all they're doing is wrapping the view you're creating there in a view that just sets changes in environment value. And so like a lot of these modifiers, it's very easy. You don't even realize that you're changing the environment value sometimes. I'll give you a good example. Like text alignment is one of the things that's in the environment value. So are you left aligned? Are you centered? Are you right aligned?
Mm-hmm.
You apply that as a modifier, but all it really does is wrap that text view that you're creating there in a parent view that sets its environment to have a certain alignment. And therefore any subviews of that will also, so let's say you've got a box and you've got, let's say like a little form and you've got three texts inside it in a V stack. If you set left or centered on the V stack, you would want all the things in the V stack to get centered, right?
Right.
I mean, that makes sense. Or if you want to right align that V stack. The reason that works is because when you set that alignment, it's changing at the moment that VStack is being created. It's changing the environment value of text alignment from that point down in the hierarchy for everything to be write aligned until something else overrides it.
Got it. Okay.
I know it's, let me tell you, this is as a paradigm, this is like, it is just so different from what we're used to. That's the horror and the fun of it.
True. I just, as you were explaining it, I just thought, well, this is a combination of composite design pattern and a wrapper design pattern.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah.
It's just implemented through these structs and you keep recreating it. But when you do that dot alignment thing, you wrap and return an object that wraps that original object that you called it on, but the type matches. So it's a composite, and it's a composite because it's a tree.
Yes.
With the same types everywhere. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense how it works under the hood. I still have lots of questions though. I think we're probably for this episode, we're kind of reaching the time. So let's do this. Let's go and talk about the last one that we didn't talk about, at state. How does that one work?
Cool. So at state is meant to hold just a single value. So it's not like some object that has lots of values and it can update, but it's a single value and it's intended to be private only to that view. So it's really more, you can think of it not as data, but more as like view configuration. So for example, is this button visible or not visible? Even like what text might say, if you have some text that can change dynamically, you could make that some state. So it's basically a very simple property, but it just has that magical special aspect to it that if you change it, it will trigger, because how your body is rendered depends on that value. If you change that value, either by someone clicking something or tapping something or certain amount of time passing, what have you, if you change that value, the body will be re-rendered to use the new value from that state. The other magical special thing about state, you know, we talked about how Swift UI views are structs, so you cannot mutate any property on a struct. It's not allowed. But state is a property wrapper, and it actually stores that property in a hidden location in a storage place somewhere. So under the hood, it's the only kind of property that you can actually change inside your Swift UI view. So that's why when you put a button in there and you say, when someone taps this button, I want to change this other view to be visible. You can change that is other view visible state because it's this property wrapper that stores the actual value. So you're never mutating the struct. You're kind of mutating this special place where it's hiding its data and at the same time signaling to re-render the body. So that's state. So the simple thing with state is just to remember it doesn't come from outside. State never comes from outside of the view that's using it.
Can you inject it still though and then assign right away in the initializer?
You can assign like a value for
sort
it.
The starting value.
Exactly. You could certainly construct or inject a starting value. But it is kind of internally managed by the view. And you can think of it as just these flags that we've all written a million of in the past that is this thing on or off? Am I going left or right? Is it the big constraint or the small constraint?
That's
all state.
So this is what I want to ask then. First, does it have to be a primitive, meaning a bool and an int and so on only? Or could it be an object?
It can be any type.
So, okay. And then the way you trigger this views update or state change that triggers the view update you override that property with a new value, right? So if it was a bull and it was false, you say, let's say it's an is enabled or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Then you say self.isEnabled equals true, mm-hmm. and that would trigger that at states is enabled change. Mm-hmm. But, and that's clear because that's a primitive and you override. Mm-hmm. But what if that object is a more complex, like view model thing? But, and I understand, yes, you, if you say self.viewModel equals new view model, it will also trigger that by the same analogy or in same logic, trigger that change. But what if you modify a value inside of that existing at view model or existing view model object? Will that trigger a change cascadingly?
Oh, I see what you're saying. That's a really good question. I guess potentially.
So it's a mutation. Or do you need an observable object for that specifically?
I would have to test that. Because, you know, my first instinct is, so I'm disclaimering, I don't know for sure. My first instinct is like, well, it probably wouldn't re-trigger, right? Because it's just a pointer to an object. Something inside the object is changing. But because you're not setting a new value of the whole object on there, it may not be triggering a re-render.
I am guessing. I also don't know, but I'm guessing, and by sort of recalling what I quickly skimmed and read about it and heard, mm-hmm. that's the sort of the difference between at state and at observed object.
Yeah.
That's because that's why it has a publisher to broadcast those changes. So with an at observed object, you're not reassigning the object itself on your property in your view, right. But you're observing mutations on it of its properties. And with an at state, it's the other way around. You literally have to just override it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And for that reason, it's again, you can kind of depend on that value semantics thing mm-hmm. where even if it's a very complex struct, any change you make to an actual property of a struct, not necessarily like, again, if the struct has a property that's just a pointer and you change something inside that object, that doesn't matter. But if it's a struct with struct properties, then anything you change anywhere in there regenerates, like creates a new value of the whole thing and calls the setter of the state on it. So it would certainly trigger a state change. But it makes sense. I think you're right. I think just changing a property on an object would probably not get you a re-render.
Yeah, and I think the reason also my gut feel would be for the reason for that. Observing, so you could say, well, why don't you just system observes everything and all the properties on that object and like recomputes it for me? That just could be too many observations. This is why with the at observed object, you yourself explicitly declare what's observed and triggers the change. And you could have way more other properties internally in that observed object that do not trigger the change that yes. you need for your own logic, mm-hmm. because otherwise it's just too expensive.
Yeah.
And or maybe unnecessary. Maybe you just want, maybe you have like a counter for the sum when like it's a progress bar or whatever and it reaches some certain threshold and only then you want to refresh. So counting the threshold internally in your at observed object will be mutation internally, but you don't want to do anything until it reaches the threshold. And then you render the UI. So you call the sync or whatever it's called on that publisher, right?
Oh, right.
Push the data.
Oh,
broadcast rather.
Yeah, ascend, right.
Or send, yeah, I don't know. Don't remember how it's called.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, that's absolutely true. And so, yeah, these are the really interesting wrinkles of mm-hmm. of how it works. And so, yeah, there's a lot of ability, exactly like you described, I guess, to customize that behavior. But I think coming full circle to that introduction, one of the challenges is just one thing that SwiftUI doesn't have a good story for, in my opinion, is if you've got a complex series of screens, you know, SwiftUI, every possible transition you could do from every view is all expressed as part of this giant view hierarchy. If you've got like 10 layers of 20 different views, and they've all got at environment object dependencies, you can easily, you won't know that you forgot to set one of them up until someone navigates to it and you crash. If it's all using observed objects, how do you get the view model to that thing that's like 10 layers deep? You got to pass it through every parent view, every view that built the view that built the view that's going to get that to that view. So, you know, the dependency injection story for data, I think you've got the two extremes. You've got either like incredibly direct hot potato constructor injection, or you've got incredibly unsafe, invisible to the compiler. You'll never know it's broken until you actually run the app and navigate there. Kind of injection. And those are your two options in SwiftUI.
And to clarify, that makes sense. But to clarify, so the hot potato version would be what you call hot potato is basically passing it through each view, right? So let's say, as you said, 10 layers deep, you need a view model. What should I call it? Title label view model. I don't know, right?
Yeah, sure.
Because the title label is 10 layers deep for some reason. Then way up in the root, I guess when you create the UI host in view controller and you give it your original root Swift UI view, that's where you would have to inject that observed, what's it called? Observed object?
That's where you would essentially do it.
And then you keep passing that observed object of that specific type that subview, title subview wants 10 layers deep. You keep passing through each initializer that eventually will that uses the parents of the views that eventually lead to that title view?
Exactly. Oh. Or if you look at it this way, because the title view maybe wouldn't be have its own separate model, but let's take
it's a bad example. I'm just sort of making it up. Yeah, but let's say it does, right? Let's say that title view needs to be updated upon some socket connection data coming in all the time, right? So it needs to be observed and actually recomputed. So then you will have to do that.
And that's right.
Pass it down. And then that's just one view. And you have, you, if you have many observables exactly. like that, you just get a gazillion injected.
It multiplies. So right. if you imagine an app that has like three tabs, very standard iOS app, three tabs, and each tab, let's say, has a list, starts with a list controller and then goes to a detail. And let's say each list has one view model and the detail has a different view model.
Oh, I know where you're going.
So now you have three times two. Mm-hmm. You've got six different view models that root view has to make sure to pass all the way through.
Yes. Well, that's actually even another topic of the navigation. We'll get to that in another episode.
Right.
Another story. But to just to take a step a little back to the hot potato versus another approach. Or another approach where... Oh, wait. But before I go there with the, in the UI kit world, though, that there's, you would also still do a hot potato, essentially, if you want to do something like that too, right?
Not necessarily. You just have more options, I guess, because
of the protocols and stuff.
Because of the protocols.
Okay. Yeah. Fair. Yes. And that's also, we would need to dig deeper into that another time. Then, okay.
And also, Alex, because of the immutability of these things, like you can't just change something that you set as a property. Like if I just set like a combined publisher to a property in a Swift UI view, and then I start firing it, it doesn't matter. You have to hook into Swift UI's update system using one of the provided mechanisms to hook into it.
Right. And
you don't have the ability to arbitrarily hook into it. Whereas with UIKit, you can basically do whatever the heck you want to set up your update mechanism.
That's right. Okay, I see. But then with Hot Potato, you do have the compiler, benefit of the compiler telling you that types are all match and it all works before you even run it. With the opposite approach that you were talking about, that's environment.
Environment objects.
Right.
It's only resolved at runtime. And so the compiler has no idea whether that will be there at runtime or it won't.
I see. Wait, but then do you have to cast? I guess I kind of missed that technical detail of how it's implemented.
So
does the compiler match? It matches the type that you declare, but it just doesn't know if you passed the or.
It doesn't do any of those things. The compiler doesn't do any of that. What it does is it's a runtime thing, and whatever the type is that you set for an environment object variable, let's say it's list view model, it's only when you try to access it, getter says, what's my type? I'm going to use my actual type as a key in this dictionary, and I'm going to see if there's a dictionary value for this key that is my type. And it should be a value that has that type. But I don't know until runtime whether there is a value of that key.
I see. And it's what you were talking before we start to record. Now I understand the problem. The key, the type is the key. So if you have in your subviews, you have the same type, does it get overridden then?
It will always return the
same.
Type.
And if you, as you were saying before in an example where for some reason, somewhere in the middle of your hierarchy, you want to override the environment. Well, environment object in this case, not the environment. Then it overrides for that type. And then
That's a good question. I assume so because it's probably like a copy on write sort of structure, just like a dictionary. So I assume so. The problem is though that those overrides happen in the view, and how would a view know where to initiate
sure,
data?
Yeah, that's fair. Right. But let's say it does somehow. Yeah.
Let's say it does. Okay. Yeah. No, you're right. I suspect, and again, I haven't tried that, but I suspect that you could override from a parent to its child hierarchy. You would be able to override it and just say, oh, for anyone below me, you get a new value for that type. If it had a way of creating that. The other really weird, and this I hope is going to be sorted out in the latest updates to Swift UI at DubDub this year, but if you actually present a sheet, the interesting thing about a sheet is it creates a new hierarchy and it does not copy over your old hierarchy automatically. Your environment and your environment objects are not copied over. So if you navigate in a, like do three pushes inside a Swift UI hierarchy, and then you do a present, a sheet, that sheet does not have the environment objects you gave to the root. And it does not have the environment values that you set either.
Even though the view that you present in the sheet was declared
created
deep down in that hierarchy.
Right. The implicit passing doesn't happen. So you can copy everything, but you have to manually copy all of the values that you carry about over, that you care about.
Oh, God. Okay. That's plus one topic to the topic of navigation for another episode. Yes.
Yeah. I know they're going to. They've got to be working on fixing that. I feel like that's just a we didn't get to it yet sort of issue, but it's an interesting wrinkle.
I see. Okay. Well, this was a great conversation. We've covered a lot. Actually, not what we wanted originally, but that's okay.
That's true. Best conversations, I guess, are 80% unplanned, right?
I mean, I think I learned a lot. I actually understand way better how it works and how to use it.
So a little bit of fandom?
Oh, no, not yet. No way. Because all of those parking lot of the other topics and issues to discuss that we'll get to in other episodes, that's still on the table.
Yeah.
But at least it's slightly more clear now on sort of where to use, when to use what, and how it works, all of that, right?
Yeah, awesome.
Cool. All right, Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Yeah. And again, yeah, where everyone can find you and pin you and say, Swift UI is awesome, teach me more, things like that.
Oh, I'm not good enough to teach. Probably just danielhall.io. That's my blog, and it's got links to my Twitter and GitHub and stuff on there.
Awesome. And yeah, you guys can reach us at hello@insideiosdev.com and Twitter us at insideiosdev. And we'll see you next time.